Hello again, and welcome back to Pirated Radio. This is episode 17. Yep, I think it's 17. In this episode, I speak to a designer who I'm sure if you're listening to this, you probably know, called Malcolm Garrett. If you don't know Malcolm, he is famous for doing a lot of work in the music industry, with his most notable works probably being his work for the Buzzcocks, he's worked for Duran Duran, Simple Minds, Heaven 17, and Peter Gabriel. And I speak to Malcolm about his earliest influences, including some of the movies he used to watch growing up and TV shows, and also his very early interest in architecture. We then touch on his ties with Manchester, and also if it's possible to even come up with an idea which shocks people anymore. I also ask him what he looks for in students' portfolios, and we have a bit of a chat about comparing his work to that of Peter Saville's, who is obviously one of a great friend of his. So yeah, I hope you enjoy. As you've mentioned a few times in different recordings and interviews that you've done, your interest in graphic design came from sort of your toys and things when you were younger.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But some of your first stuff that you sort of took notice of was more architecture, and in particular the Post Office Tower in London, which is now the BT Tower.
In fact, here we have.
That is the Post Office Tower.
And what is great about this book is it is the Post Office Tower, and it's a beautiful piece of typography. You know, it's really deliciously executed, and so it was certainly that kind of flavor of modernism, I guess, and modernist thinking, kind of clean lines, modern architecture, sans serif typography, you know, kind of gridded layouts, which I was certainly noticing in the real world. And was echoed. I mean, it's safe to say was echoed in the TV programs and films and media that I liked. I just did a podcast interview with Jamie Anderson, who's Gerry Anderson's son, which was great. And I'm literally talking about all of those TV programs that I watched as a child from the age six. I worked out that I watched all these programs like Supercar, Fireball XL5, Stingray, Thunderbirds, Captain Scarlet, Joe 90. So I was watching them right until my teenage years, from the age of six. And what was great about those programs was that sense of optimistic futurism. You know, it was the look was very contemporary, and the contemporary look, like the Post Office Tower, was visionary. And was based in technological developments that are taking place. I mean, certainly the Post Office Tower was, I think I'm safe in saying it was the first architectural structure of its type that literally its function was telecommunications, and you know, was connecting the world. And they were themes that were picked up in those Gerry Anderson TV programs. So certainly, yeah, I was soaking that up from the age of six, and those things were inspiring me in all sorts of subliminal ways, I guess, because I wasn't, you know, at the age of seven, you don't really have an analytical brain, do you? Even at the age of 11, you don't. Even at the age of 21, I didn't. Things are very instinctive. And so that was all the stuff that I instinctively enjoyed as a child, and I think it's also worth saying that I benefited from the fact that those TV programs were very grown up in their approach. You know, they dealt with adult themes in a way that was receptive to children, but they never really talked down to children. They were you know, they elevated, they elevated the discourse, as we'd say in academic in the academic world. So yeah. So did I answer your question or did I interrupt too early?
No, that's fine. The question was originally, because obviously the post office tower, it's an architectural thing. It's not necessarily a graphic design thing, although, as you mentioned, it kind of all connects in when you're younger anyway, doesn't it?
But it does.
Have you ever thought about what your career might have looked like had you gone completely in the architectural route as opposed to graphics?
That was interesting in your question, because I hadn't really. I think I actually came to the understanding that actually I was probably not that good at architecture. I probably wouldn't have made a good architect. I was inspired by the forms and the shapes and the structures of architecture, which I brought into a two-dimensional, and a graphic space. And it's certainly that appreciation of space and environment, I think, were kind of sort of abstract concepts that I certainly built into my design work. So I always thought, or looking back, I realized I'd been thinking of record sleeves, which is how I, probably why you're talking to me, because I made my professional break, if you like, was given through the music industry. But I always looked at a record sleeve as a flat box with a round thing in it that didn't have a right way up, and more than that, was a package for something that had no physical form. It was a package for sound, and so I'd always instinctively, and I'd always thought of record packaging as a three-dimensional, a three-dimensional construct to house something that had no physical form, and I certainly. I mean, I don't think I was conscious of it in quite those terms when I started doing it. But what I was conscious of was that for me, the front and the back of a record sleeve were just as important. I never saw the idea of a record sleeve as my contemporaries at that time. The contemporaries that I was responding to were the in-house record company art departments that liked to put a picture of the band on the 12-inch square. Or the sophisticated photographic ideas of people like Hypnosis, who again were thinking of the record sleeve as almost as a gallery wall, and then you had the god awful illustrations by Roger Dean and his imitators, and I definitely was reacting against those. That way of looking at a record sleeve, and my way of looking at a record sleeve, as I say, was to think of it as a flat box, and think beyond that, and also think of it as part of a wider or a broader range of connected artifacts, whether they were the singles from the album, or whether they were the posters for the album, whether they were the badges that you wore to promote the album, or whether it was as it went on, as it became the website and the digital components of music. I can see the logical connections of that way of thinking enabled me to embrace something that was I guess ultimately fast forwarding to the 90s and my interest in digital, I'm thinking of architecture of information in virtual space, so in a way I did become a kind of architect, because I was always thinking about the way things are presented sort of in your mind in a three-dimensional way, but to go back to your original question, would I have made a good architect? Probably not. Probably not. I mean, I know quite a few architects now, and I don't want to be harsh, but I don't see eye to eye with too many of them. if I'm being hypercritical, even of the architects who have built some of the buildings that I love, if I was critical of them, they build buildings for themselves and not for the people who occupy them. You know, that's the my ultimate criticism of certainly actually the architecture that I liked in the 60s, which I guess might be why I like the Post Office Tower. It is that shape because it's doing a job. And, you know, it tells you exactly what it's about. It's a beacon there. Yeah, I'll stop there.
So obviously your work has been closely tied to the city of Manchester, and I've asked a couple of people this through all my interviews because a lot of them are just weirdly from Manchester. But what do you think separates Manchester apart from kind of the other cities? Like, I'm from Stoke-on-Trent, and Stoke is stuck in, like, it's very much stuck in its ways in sort of the 70s, 80s, where it produced a load of pottery. It's now died off, but we're still sort of holding on to that pottery thing, weirdly. But Manchester seems to have gone from strength to strength to strength.
It's an interesting question, and one I thought about a lot, because I was actually born in Northwich in mid-Cheshire. And literally on the banks of the Trent and Mersey Canal, which was built to it was built to connect Stoke and Liverpool, so to actually get the pots from the potteries to the port of Liverpool and send them on their way. So I'm not actually from Manchester. My parents were from Liverpool, in fact, and up to the age of 11, until I went to grammar school, all of my experience of a large city was based around Liverpool, and I grew up in the 60s, so Liverpool was massive in the 60s, you know, with the Beatles and with comedians like Jimmy Tarbuck and Ken Dodd, and obviously the football, you know, Liverpool and Everton were then and still are major football teams, Premier League football teams, or League Division One as it was in the 60s, and so the influx of ideas up to the age of 10 or 11 was Liverpool based, and I knew nothing about Manchester, and then I went to grammar school. I went to a Catholic grammar school, which was in Greater Manchester. It was in Altrincham, just outside Altrincham, and I took the train to go to school. And so between the ages of 11 and 17, I was travelling daily into Greater Manchester. And the train I got actually went all the way into Manchester. You know, I got off obviously before it there to go to school. But sometimes I would go all the way to Manchester. And so it became easy for me to travel into Manchester. And this isn't going to answer your question, but it does illuminate why the question should be asked, because Liverpool was a city, and Liverpudlians were full of character, you know, that even today, you know, still, you know, they've got a very distinct accent, and they've got this kind of a very I was going to say cynical, but not a cynical way of looking at the world. They've got a very they have a curious take on the world, which comes through in all their conversation. You know, and you don't get that in Manchester. In fact, I came to think of Manchester as in the same way that the fish don't notice the water. I didn't notice Manchester. I thought Manchester was the default city, you know, it was a vanilla city. And it was only much later, it was after I, and then eventually I went to live in Manchester when I was at the Polytechnic, and it just felt very natural and comfortable, and still does. I go to Manchester and I just feel, it's weird, I feel almost nothing because it feels like the right place to be. And when I left Manchester to come and live in London, I began slowly to realize, and as I traveled the world, you know, professionally, you know, throughout the 80s and 90s, I came to realize that Manchester was special for that very reason, that it was just very natural place to live. And so I came to a new understanding, if you like, or a new appreciation of Manchester. And then I started to, Manchester, Mancunians don't, or traditionally haven't really shouted about themselves. They tend to be negative. You know, it's like, if you don't like it, fuck off, kind of thing, you know, and as opposed to like, oh, but you must like it because we do this. And Liverpool had shouted about itself. You know, it was great to be a Liverpoolian. You know, Liverpool was a great place to be. But Mancunians didn't do that. And so consequently, I didn't know much about, literally, I didn't know much about Manchester's industrial history. I, you know, so much was taken for granted because it was just around me. And I, as I started to learn more and more about the place that Manchester had in, you know, in the history of the recent history, you know, the last 200 years, as opposed to most other places in the UK, you know, have a history that goes back 1,000 years or 2,000 years, you know. Chester, which actually is the closest city to where I was born, you know, goes back to Roman times. It's a Roman city. But before the Industrial Revolution, there wasn't really anything in Manchester. And it grew up because of that industry. I mean, I'm literally doing some research for another project in Manchester and looking at how important immigrants moving into Manchester were for its growth, and it really did grow almost from nothing, you know, from the early 1800s onwards, when it was, you know, the home of the cotton industry and then the railways industry and even all of those canals that we spoke about were there to connect all of the industry around Manchester, in and through Manchester. So what is it about Manchester? I think it's just a great, because it has that nobody bothers you, but it's a platform to do what you want. And so it's been, you know, over the past 50 years, I guess, 50, 60 years, it's been a place where you could do things. You wouldn't be, you know, it's relatively straightforward to get on and do things. And the Mancunian attitude is, we'll just do it ourselves. You know, it's like, you know, we don't care what you think. We'll just do it. And that sort of can-do attitude coupled with a lack of desire to be competitive has allowed things to happen and people to grow and prosper in that space in a quite of natural and forthright kind of way. That's the best I can come up with, really. It's been a good place to do things, and in more recent times it's kind of the city itself has realized its own worth. You know, it's like most cities in the UK in the kind of post-war era. You know, it went through difficult times, and you know, but beginning in the 60s, I think there was a sense of growth in the city. You know, you can look at Granada TV, for example. The first TV station outside of London was based in Manchester. You know, it's like we broadcast it ourselves. You know, you can't underestimate the TV programs like Coronation Street or films like A Taste of Honey or Room at the Top or those kind of gritty northern films gave another acceptable view of Manchester that eventually Manchester came to terms with the fact that it's a great city, and now it competes. Now it's there to compete. And you know, if you were a historian, you might look at the change that came about the city following the Commonwealth Games. It hosted the Commonwealth Games. Can't remember what year. Should do, really. But that was the first time in recent history where people who weren't Mancunians came to the city and saw that it was good and said good things about it. And you know, because Manchester's always had a sort of, whilst it's not been competitive, it's always had a rivalry, certainly with Liverpool and certainly with any town the other side of the Pennines over the hills. So it's had a sort of sense of rivalry, which in the past has meant that Manchester kind of almost built a wall around itself, you know, and it became more introspective. Following the Commonwealth Games and other things, you know, Manchester United can't be, you know, discounted, and obviously the music scene that developed at post Sex Pistols and post Buzzcocks, that played its role, and now Manchester's much happier with itself and much more able to compete and to promote itself. So you couple that, you know, it's this sense of Manchester as a sort of natural, warm place to live, and you couple that with the positive regeneration and the reassessment, the self reassessment of the city, then it's just great to be in Manchester.
So yeah, I was listening to an interview, I can't remember which one it was. I've listened to a crap load coming up to this, trying to do some research. But you spoke about how when you were growing up, you could do something like cut your hair a different way, and that sort of, it provoked a load of outrage in people, but sort of going forward over time, that's less of a thing that you can do now. And it sort of made me think about ideas as a whole, and how a lot of stuff is just being done. And now you kind of think a lot of the times going into a brief, it's kind of like, what can I do? Because everything has been done in a sense. So do you think that, you know, new ideas are even a thing that can be done at this point? And I guess more groundbreaking, you know, shocking ideas in a sense.
Well, it's a really difficult question to answer. Because I'm now 65, and when you're 15, you instinctively do things, and you're not able to fully comprehend why you do stuff, and it's only later in life you look back and you realize, oh right, yeah, that's what I was like, and so a lot of the things I didn't necessarily cut my hair a particular way to be outrageous, but in doing that, you found that that you were being outrageous. You know, first of all, you know, I grew my hair long at school, you know, because I was into heavy rock, you know, like Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple and Hawkwind, you know. So I was very much into influenced by the tail end of the 60s, you know, the kind of post Summer of Love and the beginnings of the counterculture in the UK. But I was too young to play an active part of it. So by the time punk happened, I was receptive for something that had that kind of countercultural flavor, that also was a vehicle for the creative ideas I was having as a budding graphic designer. So you don't really understand when you're that age why you do those things, or you don't understand why people don't. You sort of, it's a double-edged sword. You can't, because, you know, like you say, you know, as a punk, you cut your hair and you dye it blonde or you dye it black, and you sort of, you, because you think it looks good and you want to stand out, but you don't quite understand why it is so outrageous. And Lily Allen said something recently that I kind of really, really identified with. She said, "I don't try to be different. It's just that I don't want to be the same as anyone else." So when you're 15, 16, you're trying to find what is your own identity. Who are you, and where are you going in the world, and you don't really have the the, you know, the equipment, the mental equipment to assess that. And I think, you know, I argue that's why you kind of identify with particular bands or particular musicians, because they're able to vocalize the sentiments that are going on in your mind in ways that you're not yet equipped to. And so music becomes very, very important to you as a, you know, in your late teens and early 20s when you're finding yourself. It's certainly true for me. So I identified with, most specifically, with this band Hawkwind, and aspired to live a lifestyle that I saw these people living, and then saw a direct connection with the Sex Pistols and punk exploding at a time when I'd left home and I could lead that life. I was then the right age. So going back to your question, which I think your question is, do I think that power of ideas and that power of expression of identity has the same effect? And my answer is, I've no idea. And I've no idea because I'm the wrong age. And I think if you ask that question to the young, you know, if I was the younger me today, you know, you asked me that question, then I'm sure I'd find things that I would want to rebel against, do things in an outrageous way. Yes, we're certainly much more, you know, society is much, much more receptive of how you present yourself, what clothes you wear. You know, I'm just thinking, you know, back when I was 16, nobody had piercings, nobody had tattoos. You certainly didn't dye your hair strange colors. And the kids today, you know, I see what you're saying. It seems like it's impossible to upset people. But I think there are different ways to do that, and I'm personally not somebody who gets upset. So A, I'm not the person to be doing it, and B, I'm not the person to be noticing it as distressing. But I'm sure it's out there. Well, you do actually see it. I mean, in the post Brexit world, in the post truth world, society is becoming much more divisive. You know, there is a real us and them scenario out there, and it's much more dangerous than just teenagers wearing funny clothes. You know, it's genuinely dangerous. You know, and thank God we have gun control in this country. You know, because you see that kind of rebellion having literally lethal consequences in the United States. So I think the short answer is things remain the same. Human beings grow and develop in the same ways. I think that what we're talking about, or what, you know, what you're asking about, is we need to look in different places for it. And I'm not necessarily the right place to look. You might be a better place, and you can tell me. So do keep on asking that question, because I think it's really important. And it's, you know, and I do discuss this with my you know, with my contemporaries, with colleagues. I remember having a conversation with Fred Deakin, who now teaches at UAL, but he had a band called Airside, a design company called Airside, and before that a band called Lemon Jelly, and he teaches and has gone through that whole process, you know, the whole life development similar to my own, but in a different location. And he says the same thing. It's like we're not equipped to know where to look to find those things, those new things, those new attitudes. Hopefully, you know, the youth that we're talking about, they've probably learned how to hide, how to keep it to themselves, how not to confront. Yet they're doing confrontational things in different spaces, whether that's in cyberspace, virtual reality, or just in underground places. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I refuse to believe it's gone away.
you touched on VR then. One of the questions I wanted to ask yourself is, obviously your company was one of the first companies that really went truly digital in a time where there was sort of a switch from traditional means to digital means, and there was sort of friction in that with a lot of companies not really wanting to switch, and you just jumped straight ahead and did it. I was going to ask about why you did that, but I think that's been covered in other podcasts, and also I'm really wary about time. What are your thoughts on sort of VR and AR then? I know that through Design Manchester, you've been doing things through VR, haven't you, I believe?
We did a little bit. We staged an exhibition with the Shangri-La people from Glastonbury. We did an exhibition called Lost Horizon. The exhibition was called Yours Truthfully, and it was in the Lost Horizon virtual reality environment. So yeah, I'm very interested, and have been for a long time, since the early 90s. You know, there's the idea of cyberspace has been something that has interested me, and it goes back to Gerry Anderson. You know, I was always interested in space and science fiction and technology, and where those things overlapped with art and design. Is the space or the environment, the spatial environment that I've always been excited about. Let's be honest, I'm too old to be the pioneer in those spaces, but I am old enough to be interested in it, and wherever possible, be part of providing, helping to provide an environment for innovative things to happen in those spaces, which is why Design Manchester is so important to me, because I like to think that I'm helping put something back into the space, into the world that provides spaces for that youthful innovation to thrive. You know, if I'm able to provide platforms that people want to build on, then that's the best I can do with my years of experience, if you like, and the position I find myself, you know, within the within industry. I should be part of the environment that can promote innovation. And also, I hope that through that I learn things. You know, I learn more about these spaces and how they can, you know, because there are two good phrases about the future. There's the traditional one is I'm now going to misquote, but if you want the future, you have to build it. But the other one is the only thing about the future you can predict is it won't be anything like what you predict. And turning that around, so that's why I'm interested in looking at things and seeing what's happening, because all you can do is create a platform, and then it's up to others to take it in directions that you couldn't even conceive of. And that's the interesting thing. I'm interested in the things that I'm not able to conceive of. They're the things that excite me.
Jumping forward then, I've got a segment, and it is the only segment of the show that I've started doing recently, where I ask each person to bring something along. It's basically I've ripped off Desert Island Discs and turned it into one thing. But if somebody came up to you and asked you one thing that has been sort of seminal in your career that they could go away and research and look at, be it a book, a painting, a person, you know, a piece of music maybe, that they could go away and look at and then pull things from for their own sort of career, what would you pick if you had to pick one thing?
That's an interesting question. And somebody asked me something similar in a podcast recently. And I said something mundane, like, you know, my iPhone or something. And I thought afterwards, do you know what? I missed the opportunity to say that the most, one of the most, if not the most, pivotal moment in my creative development was taking LSD. And my first acid trip as a, as a 17-year-old, on a hitchhiking trip to Holland, went to Amsterdam, took LSD in Amsterdam. It completely changed the way I looked at life and looked at myself. You know, more than any other single thing ever. I mean, lots of other things are cumulative. You know, we talked about Gerry Anderson. I just talked about technology, and you know, I'm amazed at where the iPhone's got from that point you mentioned earlier of me taking an early interest in going digital. What I knew about going digital in 1989 to 1990 was that, as I said, you can't predict the future. It was I didn't know where things were going to go, but I knew that they were going to go somewhere really significant. You know, after seeing that seeing the first computers in the studio, I just thought this is going to change everything. So you could say, you know, so one answer to your question could have been the Mac Plus, which is my first Macintosh computer, but in actual personal terms, the thing that changed me so much and changed my outlook, changed the way I understood life, the way I represented things on paper, you know, my creative work, if you like, my artistic work, everything changed after taking that first acid trip in whatever it was, June 1973 or 74. So I would say that.
I didn't expect that, I'll be very honest with you, but I'm very happy with the answer, I'll be honest.
Good.
Obviously, yeah, it's kind of weird jumping on. I'm talking about your time. I want to ask you some more studenty questions now, so jumping on.
Okay, no problem.
That.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously,
happy to talk about anything.
You've got a lot of ties with the Manchester School of Art, and from what I understand, you were an external accessor. Somebody, my lecturer told me yesterday that at one point you were supposed to be an external accessor for my university at some point, at Staffordshire University, but apparently fell through or something.
I've no idea. I don't. I'm trying to recall, but I do forget so many things. But I've been external assessor at a lot of universities, both in the UK, in Ireland, in Denmark, even across the United States. Again, this relates to me, you know, what is my role in professional life as a 65-year-old? Well, my role is to try and encourage the kind of person I was when I was 18 or younger, you know, to spot the individual and encourage the individual and to help them kind of grow into the space that they should grow in and be supportive and receptive to ideas. So it's quite possible I was I was going to be an external at your college. I can't remember it, but then that's a reflection on me, not a reflection on anyone else, certainly not a reflection on your college, and I'd be receptive to being asked again. So yes, I think actually the last external I did was at Manchester Met, at Manchester School of Art, which I think ended in 2012. So it's a good 10 years ago. Is that 10 years? Yes. Yeah. my math is not so good. But before that, I've been external at Salford University. I've been external at Central St. Martin's. I've been involved with the Royal College on, you know, I've been, as well as being external, I've been on mentoring programs, and I'm keen always to take interns. I mentioned this morning, I've got an intern started with me from from Goldsmiths. I've been taking interns from Goldsmiths for about 4 years now. They're great because part of what I do is whether it's with Design Manchester or whether it's other events-based activities, the kind of things I do and the kind of things we do at Images & Co, I must give credit to, not credit, but I must mention my creative and business partner, Casper de Graaf, who I've been working with since 1981. Between us, we get involved in all sorts of community or education or exhibition type activities. And part of the course at Goldsmiths is to do an internship. The course is called Arts Management, so they come and do an internship and with companies that can help with the kind of interest they have in arts activities. And so Daniela has joined me as of last week, and so she'd be helping on two or three specific. It's part of the course, you know. So it works really well, you know. It's like there are specific tasks that need taking care of here. She can come and help with those specific tasks, and you know, gives a kind of significant amount of time, and then it counts as a module in her course. So it's, you know, we both end up being winners. So what was your question?
it was basically, so you mentioned interns. So when you're looking at a student's body of work, I assume you've looked at hundreds over your years.
I have.
What is it that you're looking for, essentially? Do you have a thing
you're looking for? I'm looking for identity. I'm looking for being passionate about something. The last external thing I did at Manchester, there was one particular student I looked at. She wasn't the only student I thought was good, but this particular student, I read her notebooks. I'm always more interested in the notebooks than the portfolios. I mean, the portfolios, you kind of get a good sense of like, yeah, this person can draw a bit, or this person's good with typography, or this person's good with whatever it might be. But in the notebooks, the notes a person keeps, you know, the sketches they make, the things they write about themselves or about their interests is very insightful. And this one particular student had written about, she'd written two things that I noticed. She'd written that she'd done several internships at various places, and she'd written about what she'd gained from those internships. And I thought, okay, here's a person who's kind of keen to look outside of the college environment. And then secondly, she wrote about a particular photographer who was quite well known, who she really admired and she would really love to work with. Now, it transpired that that I knew this photographer, and not only that, I knew somebody, and he ran a little design group, and I knew the person who was the head of a particular part of this design group, and so I just thought, well, I'm not going to kind of. You make a decision. Okay, so how can I help this person? And you can only help people by, as I've tried to explain earlier, by providing a platform. So, I sent two emails after the process was over. I sent two emails, and I sent an email to the person who worked with the photographer, and I said, if you get a call from this particular person, you could do well to take a look at her book, and left it at that. And then he emailed the student and said, look, you've expressed an interest to work at this place. I happen to know somebody there. Why don't you drop him an email and see whether you can have a conversation with him? So I left it at that. And I thought, if she follows it up, then it was worth me making the recommendation. She did. And she's gone on to great success since. And so the answer to your question is, what do I look for in a portfolio? I look for the person I look for the person, the personality, the passion, the drive, the commitment, the desire to do something, coupled with obviously a base set of skills. it's all very well having a drive to being a kind of a striker for Manchester United, but if you're no good at football, you're not going to get there. But you may be really good at football, but unless you have the drive to be the striker at Manchester United, so you need to combine the two. So that's what I look for. I don't look, in fact, I almost look, I was going to say, I don't look for a finished, polished portfolio. I almost look for the opposite. You want to see whether there's somebody, because you know yourself, it's a very enclosed environment in college, and it's very insular, and all of the people looking at your work during that time are experts to some degree. You know, they're either the people on your course, or they're your tutors, or everyone around you has an opinion and they're interested in what you're interested in. The first thing you find when you step outside of the college environment, you're the only person who thinks that way. And all of the conversations you have with people, unless they are, you know, fellow students, all the conversations that you soon start to think, what the hell am I talking about? Nobody understands me. And so I think it's really important. Two things come out of that that are important. One, to have a view that, to take the view as a student that you're going to learn as much or more outside of college as you're going to learn inside college. And so to always put your hand up and say, yes, I'll do that when there's an opportunity to do something, whatever it is, you know, outside of college, always take that opportunity. So that's important. And secondly, if you think you know it all and your portfolio is really polished and finished, you're not going to respond to the outside world. You're not going to be able to learn. You're not going to be able to grow. And that's the first thing that will happen to you when you leave college, is you'll realize, oh, bloody hell, it's all different out here. And you have to reassess where you are and how you go about life. So a polished portfolio is a dangerous thing to look at. You look for people who want to work with other people, want to be collaborative, want to play their part. Yeah, you want to be an expert at what you want to do, but not to the exclusion of working with alongside other experts who can do things that you can't do. Because every creative job in the real world is a collaborative job. You work with other people, and different people bring different things to the table. And graphic design should teach you that, because you go into magazines, you're working with writers, you're working with editors, you're working with photographers, you're working with illustrators, you're working with publishers, you're working with marketing people. It's a whole team. And yes, you've got to be a really good graphic designer, but you've got to be really good at embracing the needs and concerns of everyone around you. So it's not an easy thing to spot in a portfolio necessarily, but when you do spot it, that's what excites me.
So I was reading an article, and it mentioned at the top of the article that you're kind of a pioneer in branding in terms of music, which it got me thinking about your work in comparison to Peter's, because when I look at your work, I think I listened to an interview on that first Buzzcocks album, it was like one of them, you were taking the ideas of advertising design and trying to put them into more of a punk aesthetic in that. And when I think of, so that initially, so you're doing it from a sense of you are working in terms of advertising there, but when I think of Peter's work, it's more sort of, it has like an artistic quality to it almost, you know, there's often like the names of the singles and things are often like, you can't read them normally, you need to go into it more to read them and things like that. It's almost like shying away from what it is. I don't know what exactly I was trying to ask exactly.
Let me reply to the question that I think you're asking. You're looking for a comparison between me and Peter. And funnily enough, Peter and I had exactly this conversation a week ago. I sat in his studio. We did an interview for a magazine, and then we got talking about our own relative merits, you know, what it was that we had similar and the ways that we were different. And he kind of highlighted, Peter's always much more kind of eloquent than I am at explaining things, which is something that I've taken from him over the years. His ability to explain things and explain things that I instinctively felt or agreed with, but didn't necessarily know how to vocalize, as we were talking earlier, he's always been able to vocalize it. So he made the observation that, with specific relation to that first Buzzcocks album, was that he was impressed that I was able to take an idea or a way of looking at something and make it work specifically for Buzzcocks. So it's a piece of constructivist design that wasn't. He explained it another way. He said what he would have done is look at something in the book and take it out of the book and put it on the sleeve. Whereas what he admired that I'd been able to do was I'd look something at in a book and rearrange it and retranslate it and use that as the format for creating something that was new and appropriate. And so it sort of goes back to and it's not quite as clear cut as this. It goes back to what I was saying earlier about I was always interested in the package and not the sleeve. And Peter wasn't interested in the sleeve either, but he did see the sleeve much more than I did. He did see the sleeve as a vehicle for a creative idea, and so his successful pieces are they do exist as standalone things, whether it's a sleeve for New Order or whether it's that classic Joy Division sleeve. They're standalone and they're iconographic. And Peter has an amazing ability to distill everything down to that simple iconographic moment. Whereas I go the opposite way, and I kind of feed in all of the elements into a graphic environment. So my Peter's reductive and I'm expansive, but we have the same interests. So if we both looked at the same imagery as reference and then went away into separate rooms and did something, then we'd come away with completely different responses that were linked. And that has been the strength of our relationship, that we've been linked in liking and being motivated by mostly the same things. I mean, there are some things that I like that Peter doesn't get, and vice versa. But for the most part, over the period of our and we'd spend a lot of time as students talking about this kind of stuff, and so we've always had a lot of shared interests and shared motivation. But because of the kind of people we are, and because of the I don't think Peter would ever consider taking LSD, but I'm sure my taking of LSD gave me an ability to see simplicity in complexity. And Peter has an amazing ability to create simplicity from complexity, and there's lots of overlap, there's lots of complement, And we do inform one another. I mean, it's we're like a counterpoint. And so I'm always mindful of I come to realize later in life, I'm always mindful of like, how would Peter have done this? And Peter said to me, he said, do you know what? You taught me, I've only just realized this, you taught me the meaning of irony. And so he sees some of my work as ironic, i.e. taking something and putting it in a different place. Whereas he says he had to learn that, and he was lesser, he was more literal, and I was ironic. There's always a hidden thing in my work. I like it if you come to me and you say, I've liked this for 10 years and I only just spotted that thing in there. And I go, yes. So I like to add hidden layers into things, and Peter likes to take them out.
Have you ever thought about what it would have been like? I know it's a kind of a redundant question because you ultimately can't answer it, but have you ever discussed what it would be like if you'd have done Joy Division's covers, like in a parallel universe, if it was the other way around?
That's a good question. No, we haven't actually. I'm sure Peter did Joy Division covers because he was jealous of me doing Buzzcocks covers.
Yeah, because you did stuff before him, didn't you?
Yeah. Jealous is too strong. Envious. Yeah. You know, he wanted to be in the same space. But I don't think we've ever been jealous of one another. We certainly admire one another, and there is a thing in the world that there is a tendency to get angry. Or to get upset when you see a piece of work that you wished you'd done yourself. And I'm sure everybody has it. You know, when you see somebody else doing something. I listened to a podcast with Brian Eno the other day, and he said the same thing. He said, the only music I admire is the music that I wished I'd made. and there's a certain, I think... There's a bit of that in both of us, and again, that's drive. You know, if you're inspired by, because you see somebody or hear somebody or you see something and you've got, God, I wish I'd done that. It makes you want to go and do it, or to better it, So that's a really good question. Maybe I should do a Joy Division sleeve.
That would be a good exhibition, I think, because you did the one where people redid the Buzzcocks one, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, Orgasmatic Reframe. That was amazing.
Yeah.
That was amazing. Yeah. And it's a once-only thing because I think 140 people, could have been 120 or 140 designers from all over the world. The brief was simple. It's a 7-inch record sleeve. It's just the front. It's blue and yellow. The title is Orgasmatic. Do what you want. And so it was a complete a blank canvas, which you can't then repeat because nobody saw what everybody else had done. And so the first time people saw their own work in the context of that, it's like, oh, there's the other 119 or however many. And it was just fantastic. It was fantastic because some of the people knew the sleeve. You know, they were older and knew the sleeve and were like, reverential. Some people had heard of it, but hadn't really seen it, didn't know the record and maybe went out and listened. And then there were a third set, much younger, it was just two words. Orgasmatic, what does that mean? And so you had this array of reinterpretations. And everybody thought, or some people thought that it was like a competition and, you know, and they'd submit it and I'd decide whether it'd go in or not. I'd already taken the decision. If you submit something, it goes in. So for me, the idea was like not to do a better sleeve or not to even do a sleeve. But for me, the idea was to see all of them together. That was the new piece of work. It was very successful. It was great. But now you can't, you know, I can't ask anyone to do another one because they've seen the others. And so you will automatically be influenced by that.
Well, I've got two questions left. One was, I didn't do these on the email either. One I've purposely kept off because I think it's a really good question, but you're obviously an MBE now. You wouldn't strike me as somebody that would want anything to do with the monarchy. So did you ever have, at any point, Did you think about whether you would accept that? Would you ever think that I might not?
The first thing I did when I got the letter, you just get a letter saying we want to, you know, give you an MBA. Will you accept it? And the first thing I thought was John Lennon. I thought, I'm not a monarchist. I'm not a fan of the current government. I'm not exactly a communist, but I'm certainly socialist. My immediate thought was, can I accept this? Can I? Should I? And so I made two phone calls. You're not supposed to tell anybody that you're getting it, but I made two phone calls, and I called Casper, my business partner, and I asked Casper, and his response was, I called him, and I called another friend of mine who is much more anti-monarchist and much more militant, and I thought, you know, I said, look, if I accept this, Simon, will you still speak to me? And they both said, both of the people said, look, Malcolm, look at it in these terms. You know yourself, you're not a monarchist, and you can say that. But it's not, no matter who gives it to you. In the end, I got it from it was given to me by Princess Anne, who I've got moderate respect for in the context of the whole royalist thing. But think of it, it's not being given to you by royalty. It's not even being given to you by anyone in the government office that deals with it. What it is somebody has thought, one of my peers has thought enough of the work that I'm doing to recommend that, and my peers have endorsed that. So I was very clear that I was accepting it on behalf of, and there are very few graphic designers. I felt I'm accepting it on behalf of graphic design, the profession, and other graphic designers. And I was very clear about that in any kind of acceptance things. And the other thing is, it can't harm, you know. If you're thinking in terms of, you know, promoting design through Design Manchester and being taken seriously, then it goes a long way towards that. It can't be denied. You know, whether you disagree with it as an ideal, then I can and am able to use it as leverage to bring more focus on the profession, and so it is a broader thing. So the short answer is yes, I did think in first, I can't accept this. And then in consultation with people who would have a more objective view, I decided I would accept it. But also I wanted to be punk rock about it. So So I liked the fact that I would dress up to go to the palace, and I went with my girlfriend Jana, and we did get positive comments from the people, the staff there, that we looked good, and I haven't plucked up courage yet, but I would wear it publicly, I want to put it on. I'll show you. Let me just take this off.
Oh, that's cool. No, that'd be very, very cool. Yeah, I like that a lot.
I have this very rock and roll denim jacket with Hawkwind on the back and all his rebel motifs. And I just think it's got to hang off
yeah, here. That'd be amazing. I quite like that, actually.
So, you know, I just thought of myself, okay, I'm Lemmy. I'm going to wear the fucking medal.
That's amazing.
But I haven't found the right occasion to do it yet, but I will. I will.
No, I think that's a lovely way of thinking about it in terms of leveraging it like that. That's a really nice way of thinking
I definitely thought of it like, how can this benefit, you know, the industry as a whole? And if I get an opportunity to talk about it, I will highlight the fact that there are no bloody graphic designers. You know, and how many graphic designers how many designers full stop get onto Desert Island Discs? None. We're invisible. So anything I can do to become more visible, I think, is important.
I have one last question. It was from a talk you did. I don't know what year it was. I think it was about about 10 years ago. That's on YouTube. And there's a point in it where you mentioned that as a designer, you're trying not to grow up. So I wanted to know, have you grown up yet?
No, I haven't. Well, come on, I've just shown you a denim jacket. Now I'm going to hang a fucking medal on. Is that sound grown up?
No.
That was when I said somebody's asked me this question about what's been the most influential thing. It was probably the Martin Ware interview. Was that the one you listened to? That's where I said that.
Sure.
Yeah, that's where the answer I gave was being childlike, remaining not childish, childlike, just being receptive and open and vibrant and energetic and not pretending you know everything. Oh, no, actually, no. Children do pretend they know everything because they know everything they know to that point.
Yeah.
And so I want to use everything I know to that point in that way and not grow up. But it was after that interview that I said, I should have said the most important thing was LSD. Anyway, so I've done that now. But no, don't grow up. In fact, be grown up when it's right to be grown up. Don't be stupid and childish, but don't have grown-ups. The idea of growing up implies a closing down of being receptive to new ideas on new things, and I've got a 92-year-old neighbor, and she's fantastic. She lives three doors down, and we go around and have chats with this neighbor, and she's brilliant. She's quite frail, but she's just got this open mind, and she talks about stuff she's done. And at Christmas, we bundled her in my car. No, we got a taxi. We bundled her in a taxi and took her to see Grace and Perry. She's a huge Grace and Perry fan. And I just think at 92 years old, I want to be somebody who is as receptive to, because, you know, you might think, you know, Grace and Perry is the kind of person who's going to shock the elderly. We're sat with him and he's talking about S&M. And I'm just thinking, oh, right. Yeah, have I ever grown up? I hope not, is the short answer. I hope not. Brilliant.
That's a lovely way to end then. Hello again. I hope you enjoyed that. I did. I forgot to ask Malcolm his handles, where you can find him online, but he has a few different handles on Instagram. They are Collecting Malcolm Garrett, which is his personal collection. Being Malcolm Garrett, which is his just general account, I believe, and Reading Malcolm Garrett, which is the books that he's reading. On Twitter, he is just Malcolm Garrett. His website, I believe, is just malcolmgarrett.co.uk. And as ever, if you want to follow myself, I am Pirated Material everywhere. I think that's pretty much it. I shall see you next time.